This is a paid commercial program and may not represent the views of Bonneville International Corporation or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions from this broadcast are solely those of the individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, a conversation with authors, exploring ideas to improving government effectiveness, highlighting the latest trends and best practices for improving your government. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. For over a decade, the IBM Center for the Business of Government has sought to connect research to practice, sponsoring independent third-party research on a broad range of public management topics. Topics and issues important to public managers. Today, we will explore the importance of private-public collaboration and the benefits of regulatory partnerships in pursuing the business of government. We will focus on such questions as, how can government agencies work with industry using voluntary regulatory partnership programs? What steps can federal agencies take to ensure that they are effectively working in partnership with the industries they regulate? And how can agencies, in fact, collaborate, especially on the front lines of government? Whether it's working to make air travel safe, ensuring food safety, or securing the harvesting of precious natural resources, this special edition of the Business of Government Hour will discuss these questions and more with authors who performed in-depth research in these areas and offer their extended reflections on such questions. First up, the promise of collaborative voluntary partnerships, lessons from the Federal Aviation Administration, by author Russ Mills, who joins us now. Russ, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure having you.
Thanks for having me on.
Russ, in your report for the IBM Center, you examined three Federal Aviation Administration programs in which government and industry work together to identify safety hazards by using voluntary regulatory partnership programs. First, please describe for us what exactly voluntary regulatory partnerships are.
There's two types, really. There's what we call government-initiated programs and what we call industry-initiated voluntary regulatory partnership programs. I'll start with the industry-initiated. What those are is what we're probably more familiar with. It goes along with a good corporate citizen model that we've seen. This is where firms adhere to industry standards or best practices in order to achieve a regulatory compliance while attempting to be perceived as good corporate citizens. The second type that is distinguished is less familiar, but is more relevant for public managers, and that is what are called government-initiated programs. What these tend to do is reduce the focus from command and control structures of regulation where regulators are out inspecting firms of all different types. And what it does is it shifts the focus to firms self-disclosing violations to the agency in exchange for a regulatory incentive.
Russ, the focus of your report is quite timely, given recent events such as the Deepwater Horizon incident in the Gulf, which has prompted closer scrutiny of the relationship between government and industry and has raised serious questions about the viability of real collaboration between industry and the regulators.
Well, as your listeners are aware, I'm sure, there have been two major failures recently with these type of voluntary regulatory partnership programs. One occurred in the Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC, which sort of led to the financial sector collapse. The SEC was sort of relying mostly on private industry to send reports over to them instead of inspecting and regulating themselves. The other more visible failure of voluntary partnership programs was the Minerals Management Service, which led to the Gulf of Mexico oil disaster. The MMS was relying on analysis conducted by BP presented to the agency to make its determinations of the safety of mechanisms in the oil rig, such as the blowout preventer, which we all are now familiar with.
Russ, why did you focus your research on FAA?
Well, it's similar to the situations in the MMS and the SEC. In April of 2008, there was a failure of one of the voluntary programs I studied in the report, the Voluntary Disclosure Reporting Program, or VDRP. And this led to massive inspections around the country after the FAA found out that reports were being accepted into the program that really didn't meet the criteria laid out in the policy guidance. And what happened was it led to the grounding of 3,100 flights across the U.S. By both Southwest Airlines and subsequently American Airlines. And it left over 250,000 passengers delayed. Now, I picked up the news coverage of this and began to do a little digging into the FAA's voluntary programs. And despite all the bad publicity at the time they were getting from Congress and from the media, when I dug deeper into the programs, it turned out that these programs have been around for quite some time. Specifically, one of them has been around since 1975, and that these programs have actually contributed positively to aviation safety in the United States.
Russ, what specific programs did you highlight in your report?
In terms of the actual programs themselves, I looked at three. Now, the first one is the Aviation Safety Reporting System. This was created in 1975, and the FAA decided at the time that as it was a regulator, it also needed to take a step back and think, okay, are operators really going to spill their guts to the FAA without there ever being an institutional this program was new at the time, and there wasn't no institutionalized relationship. So are people really going to self-disclose their violations to the FAA, knowing that the threat of a fine is imminent? So what the FAA decided to do was go through NASA to act as an honest broker. Now, NASA, with its research and development mission, viewed this as a great opportunity because they would have access to what they call human factors data, where people are providing narratives about the mistakes they make on the front lines. So what NASA does is they, you know, anybody in the airspace system, this includes pilots, air traffic controllers, dispatchers, maintenance, a variety of groups, can submit reports to NASA. The NASA program then collects this data, issues the person who submitted the report a waiver of regulatory action. So they would still have to go through the regulatory enforcement process, but if they can produce evidence that they submitted a report to NASA, their enforcement action would be waived. And what NASA's done with this is provide a publicly available database online of all these reports. The ASRS, Aviation Safety Reporting System, ASRS, it's the only publicly available source of this type of data. And what people do is they will go in and research this data, look for systematic errors across the aviation spectrum. You know, are we seeing a number of altitude deviations at a particular airport? Are pilots missing this approach? Are maintenance personnel constantly doing the wrong type of maintenance procedure on this type of aircraft? So these types of things are able to be teased out from this data, this rich data source. The common criticism of the NASA program really is that it has a perception in the industry as being what we call a general aviation program for small aviators. So large air carriers, so you're like your United, your Americans, tend not to rely that much on the data produced from the ASRS program. And also there's a lack of awareness of the outputs of ASRS within the aviation industry. But it's still a very rich source of data, and they do produce safety alerts and alert bulletins that go to air carriers about specific issues at certain airports or within certain carriers. And one other critical feature of the ASRS data is that it's de-identified. So when the reporter submits their report to ASRS, that report is then de-identified by carrier name and by the person's name themselves. So there's no paper trail regarding which employee submitted the report. And confidentiality is critical for all these programs because, obviously, as I mentioned before, these programs have been misinterpreted. So a lot of people will think, probably rightly so, that the more safety violations that are reported by a particular carrier, that must mean there's more unsafe operations in that carrier. And this simply isn't the case. What you actually want to see is you want to see a carrier produce more self-disclosures, because it means two things. One, it means they have effective auditing processes within their organization that catch safety hazards before they turn into larger scale problems. And the second thing is, when you see a large number of reports, it means you have an effective culture or reporting culture within your organization. That's what's called the just culture, that people feel that if they voluntarily submit this data to their employee union or to the FAA, that they will not be punished. So evidence of a large number of self-disclosures in an air carrier is actually evidence of a good safety culture within that company. However, because the many members of the media tend to look at this data and think the complete opposite, that the more reports that are being issued, that means the airline is more unsafe. This data has been protected from the Freedom of Information Act under Part 193 of the Code 14 of the U.S. government. So this data is protected from disclosure under FOIA. And that's a big, important piece of this. The second program I looked at was the Voluntary Disclosure Reporting Program. This program allows companies themselves, air carriers, to voluntarily submit reports of systemic issues within their operation. The reports are sent directly to the local FAA office responsible for oversight of that carrier. They then are decided by the principal maintenance or operation inspector in that FAA office whether the voluntary disclosure will be accepted. If it is accepted, the carrier and the FAA office work collaboratively to develop a comprehensive fix to that solution, and then that fix must be implemented by the carrier within a certain time period. Usually the typical time period is 60 to 90 days from the date of that the violation was submitted. Obviously, VDRP has the highest amount of public salience because it was the one program that led to sort of the violations in Southwest Airlines during 2008. What was taking place there was the principal inspector at the FAA office responsible for oversight, Southwest Airlines, was allowing the airline to self-disclose violations that the agency already knew about. So one of the key provisions of the VDRP program is that the carrier can submit violations that the FAA is not currently aware of. If the agency is aware of the problem, then the carrier submits the violation. The FAA office is supposed to reject that. However, in this case, in the case of Southwest Airlines, they were allowing them to accept these into the program and then not making them make the corrective actions that were necessary. So it was essentially allowing planes to fly uninspected for up to 30 months. And the final case I looked at was the Aviation Safety Action Program, or ASAP. It allows employees to voluntarily submit safety-related incidents that occur on their day-to-day jobs. Their report is then submitted to what's called an Event Review Committee, or ERC. The ERC is comprised of a union representative, an air carrier representative, and an FAA representative. They sit down collaboratively and decide whether the report meets the criteria to be accepted into the ASAP program. They then decide, okay, this report's accepted. What actions could have been taken to prevent this from occurring in the future? So knowing what we know now, what could be done to prevent this from occurring again? The ASAP program also has another feature that makes it more attractive to the FAA, and that is that while this data is also de-identified by carrier and employee, the FAA operates a data-sharing collaborative called ASIAS, Aviation Safety Information Analysis and Sharing Program. This program is sort of in the beginning phases of really collecting all this data and utilizing it to its fullest effect. So those are really the three cases I looked at in depth.
So how have these programs evolved within FAA?
During the 1980s, there was really an adversarial relationship between the airlines and the FAA. During the late 1980s, the FAA began to experiment with allowing carriers themselves to play a larger role in inspections, so they would work side by side with FAA inspectors, and then to voluntarily identify and correct maintenance problems without being subject to large penalties. Now, since 1975, pilots, air traffic controllers had a program called the Aviation Safety Reporting Program, or ASRP, which allowed them to voluntarily submit things to NASA in exchange for reduced regulatory enforcement. But companies themselves had no method of submitting systematic failures to the FAA. During the early 90s, the FAA developed what's called the Voluntary Disclosure Reporting Program, which allowed air carriers to voluntarily submit violations to the FAA in exchange for administrative action instead of sort of civil penalty or fines. After a series of crashes in the mid-1990s, specifically the crash of ValueJet, a flight in the Everglades of Florida, the Clinton administration started a big initiative for public-private partnerships to encourage the free flow of information between employees and air carriers in the FAA to sort of identify systemic areas in this air system or in the aviation system that could be targeted for safety improvements. And sort of the culmination of this effort was what's called the Aviation Safety Action Program, or ASAP. ASAP is more of a codified voluntary program. It allows employees to voluntarily submit violations that they may have done on the job. So a pilot goes below a certain altitude on descent. A maintenance member puts the wrong bolt in a plane and then realizes it afterward. This program allows those people to submit to the FAA a report saying, I conducted this violation. You know, a lot of times the FAA is criticized of only reacting to problems that are brought up after an aviation disaster. But the move towards this type of safety is based really on the fact that the best way to get information about the safety of aviation is through the people who are on the front lines. And these programs are a method by which the FAA is used to collect this information.
We're here with Russ Mills, author of the recent IBM Center report, The Promise of Collaborative Voluntary Partnerships, Lessons from the Federal Aviation Administration. So, Russ, what lessons have been learned from FAA's experience with such programs?
There are some really critical lessons. The first is that these programs need to complement, not replace, traditional regulatory actions. You still need to have the stick to complement the carrot, so to speak. What this means to me is that the FAA realizes that they have to maintain the view by both the public and by industry that they are still in charge of the show. They're the regulator. They are ultimately responsible for aviation safety in the United States, even though these programs take a large chunk of that responsibility for collecting the data and shift it to air carriers, the agency is still responsible. And these programs work more effectively when each party in the group, whether it be the union, the FAA, or the employee group, realize the role that each other has to play. So one recommendation I have is that agencies who implement these bend the cost curve of a firm in their thinking about self-disclosing these types of violations. Another critical lesson that's vital for these is that these programs have to be truly voluntary. One of the things the FAA is struggling with right now is that these programs have been so successful, they're contemplating making them sort of mandatory for many carriers in the United States. The ethos of these programs is that they are voluntary, that companies are going above and beyond, and the FAA is going above and beyond to increase safety in a particular area. I believe the minute you make these mandatory or less than voluntary is what I would say, you run into some issues. People may limit their participation in certain instances, reporting only small violations instead of larger ones. You may run into people, certain employees, who wouldn't participate if they weren't voluntary. So I think you really need to make that consideration ahead of time. Also, the confidentiality clause is very vital. In the early days of these programs, the amount of reports that were being generated was very slim. And this was because people didn't trust the system. They didn't trust that their identity would be protected and they wouldn't be punished for submitting these violations. Over time, and as this data, as employees and companies realized that this data was very secure and it was protected from the Freedom of Information Act, the number of reports has skyrocketed to over 40,000 a year now. So the program is very robust, and a major reason for that is the confidentiality of the data. And a final lesson that I pulled out, and this is also critical, so the major reason the FAA gives for these programs is that they get data from carriers that they otherwise would not have access to. And if you really want to learn from that data, if you want to make regulatory change that is pragmatic and effective, it's critical you have effective and robust data analysis capabilities at both the local and national level to conduct a thorough, thoughtful analysis of the data to really dig deep and find out what are the systemic issues within each carrier in the instance of aviation regulation or within each company.
Russ, given your research, what effective management practices have led to the success of these programs? And more particularly, what are some of the limitations of such partnership programs?
One of the key management lessons that I found is that it really requires sort of a paradigm shift within the agency that And this is difficult for even the FAA, who's done this for a number of years, is that you have to get the people that are on the ground, so your inspectors or whatever workforce you have that deals with the private industry, to get on board with the notion that you are now forming a partnership, and that's a different relationship than a command and control structure. You know, they come forward with a violation, and instead of automatically turning towards, okay, what discipline can we take to prevent this from happening again, the thought process needs to be more of, okay, why did this occur? What were the factors that led to this? And what steps could be taken in the future to prevent this from occurring again? So it really requires a paradigm shift within the thinking of your frontline operators in an agency. In this model, what we're doing is allowing people in industry who often know more about the day-to-day processes than inspectors do to come up with the ideas and the safety features that they keep, the hazards they find in their operation, present those to the agency, and then work collaboratively to develop processes. The biggest limitation of voluntary regulatory partnership programs is perception. Obviously, those large-scale failures that I mentioned earlier with the MMS and the SEC have led people to really look down and look at these programs as not representing more than sort of an amnesty. To prevent that, what really needs to happen is you need to make sure that the processes and the corrective actions that you take are implemented, publicized within the company and within the FAA, and then to the larger media as a whole. If you don't take meaningful corrective actions from the data you collect from frontline operators, if you're simply allowing people to get out of jail free, what you're going to have is the perception that industry is running the show. And that's a lot of the problem that these programs have had over time.
Russ, we're all doing more with less today. How can these programs help government agencies meet their regulatory mission?
I think with the way the economic environment is and the restrictions being placed and the calls for reduced government spending, at the same time with governments being asked to do more with less resources, I think these are a great option for public managers to consider. These programs, if structured properly, and using some of the lessons I've learned that I've outlined in this document, they can reduce enforcement costs in an agency while providing an agency with a new robust data source to more effectively manage the companies or the firms that are responsible for regulating.
Russ, I'd like to focus on the future. What does the future hold for voluntary partnership programs at FAA and beyond?
Well, what's critical is agencies have to work to transform the enforcement culture in their agencies to one that that views voluntary programs and collaboration as complementary to its regulatory mission. And that's critical. And as I mentioned, agencies shouldn't view these programs as one program. They need to be viewed, you need to sort of have a portfolio of these types of programs to give a variety of different methods through which to collect data, to analyze it, and to allow employees to participate. So really having a portfolio of coordinated voluntary programs is probably the best route for agencies to go. The FAA really views these as sort of the crown jewel of their regulatory enforcement actions. The administrator actually last year made a call to action for companies, I should say for air carriers, who do not have these programs to implement them at their airlines. I hate to use the phrase win-win, but it really seems like one. Companies get, you know, increased flexibility. They could get reduced regulatory enforcement actions. At the same time, an agency gets a new source of data that would allow it to better target its inspections or regulatory activities.
Wonderful perspective, Russ, and I want to thank you again for your time.
Thank you, Michael.
We've been speaking with Russ Mills, author of a recent IBM Center report, The Promise of Collaborative Voluntary Partnerships, Lessons from the Federal Aviation Administration. You can download a copy of this report and all Center reports at businessofgovernment.org. The Obama administration's Open Government Initiative places strong emphasis on increasing collaboration. But how do agencies do this, especially on the front lines of government? When we return to the special edition of the Business of Government Hour, A Conversation with Authors, we will explore this and more with Dr. Cassandra Mosley. From contaminated peanut butter to spinach, our food safety net has shown signs of fraying, with tainted products slipping through to retail shelves, causing human harm and economic ruin. Pick up the latest Center report on food safety and find out how critical private-public partnerships are enhancing the current food safety system in America. You can order or download a free copy of this and all of our reports at businessofgovernment.org. What is risk management? How do you manage risk more effectively? How can risk management lead to better decision making? And what about applying risk management in government? Pick up the Center's report, Managing Risk in Government, An Introduction to Enterprise Risk Management, and find out. This report is especially timely given the Obama administration's focus on accountability and transparency, which has prompted a renewed focus on proper risk management and controls. You can order or download a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. The term cloud computing is suddenly everywhere, with government leaders, industry executives, and the press all talking excitedly about this new concept. Moving to the Cloud, An Introduction to Cloud Computing in Government by David Wild examines both the interest in and the technology surrounding cloud computing and why it is receiving such increased attention. It tackles such questions as, what is cloud computing? What are some of the top challenges facing government leaders pursuing cloud computing strategies? You can order or download a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. As society has become increasingly dependent on information technology in government, business, and in our personal lives, safeguarding private information created or shared on computers or the internet has taken on greater significance. How do you keep information secure in an increasingly interconnected and networked world? What is cybersecurity? Pick up the latest Center report, Cybersecurity Management in the States, and find out. You can order or download a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the special edition of the Business of Government Hour, a conversation with authors exploring ideas to improving government effectiveness. In her recent report, Strategies for Supporting Frontline Collaboration, author Cassandra Mosley describes collaborative partnerships created by the U.S. Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management with both private and nonprofit community-based organizations. They've worked together to plan and execute land management initiatives such as ecological restorations. Dr. Mosley joins us now. Dr. Mosley, would you provide us an overview of your report and what prompted your research?
In the case of stewardship contracting, this has been a very interesting tool that the Forest Service and Bureau of Land Management have had over the last half decade or so, or almost decade now, to think about how they can restore public lands and create local economic opportunity at the same time. And I got interested in linking together collaboration and stewardship contracting after sitting in a lot of meetings. You know, it's in Washington, D.C., where I was hearing senior executives and other folks saying, hey, we're collaborating. We've told people to collaborate. They're supposed to be collaborating. And then also hearing and listening in meetings at the front line saying, we wish we were collaborating more. We are trying to collaborate, but we can't do it. And somehow it was hard for the top and the bottom to meet. And what I came to believe and came to see was that that you can't just declare collaboration a strategy. You actually have to create the structures in the agencies to support collaboration. And so what's interesting to me about stewardship contracting is it's been a way that the Forest Service and BLM have taken their desire to collaborate and taken it a big step forward by creating the support structures to make collaboration easier for the agencies.
Dr. Mosley, your research is focused on stewardship contracting. What is stewardship contracting?
So stewardship contracting is a set of contracting authorities that the Forest Service and BLM were given initially through a pilot project in the late 1990s and now through a 10-year authority that allow them to combine the best of service contracting or traditional federal procurement authorities and timber sale contracting, which is the sale of timber. By bringing the best of both worlds together, that allows them to do on the ground restoration work in ways that are just not possible when you have to use one kind of set of contracting authorities to sell timber and another set of contracting authorities to purchase services. But when you're really working to restore ecosystems on public lands, you really need to have a whole bag of tools together in one contract. It reduces the impact on the land. It creates more local economic benefit. It creates a lot of administrative efficiencies. So stewardship contracting has been something that emerged as an idea in Montana and some other parts of the West and then has burgeoned over the last decade or so across the National Forest System and the Bureau of Land Management.
We're talking with Dr. Cassandra Mosley, author of a recent IBM Center report, Strategies for Supporting Frontline Collaboration, Lessons from Stewardship Contracting. Dr. Mosley, your report does a wonderful job of outlining four strategies for supporting frontline collaboration. Would you outline these strategies for us?
Sure. I think that one of the things that is critical to for senior executives perhaps to think through is figuring out how to support their collaboration and their frontline staff in collaboration. It requires really changing thinking and changing structures and changing authorities. And so what I realized as I was looking at these examples of stewardship contracting was that, and the whole process that the agencies had gone through to support it, that one of the key pieces of helping local level collaboration succeed is helping the frontline staff by creating the time and the space for them to really develop these collaboratives. Another area is to really focus on what are the rules that need to be changed to encourage collaboration. Oftentimes, this may be really focusing on prioritizing funding for actions that have been collaboratively agreed to. If a collaboration comes together, they spend 2 years reaching agreement, and then there's no money to implement the agreement. That burns a lot of bridges pretty quickly, and the collaboration will dissolve. Another critical piece of that is really to think about the importance of local discretion. If there's no real decisions to be made at the front line, why would citizens engage in the collaborative process if there's nothing to be worked through? So it's critical that people be able to make decisions at the field level. I think another strategy is to provide real incentives for collaboration, whether that's in through formal guidance and requirements that people collaborate, or aligning organizational and personal performance measures so that people are held accountable for collaborating. In both those cases, you can think about encouraging the people who, making it easier for the people who want to collaborate, and creating incentives for the people who are more hesitant. And then finally, the fourth strategy I talk about in the report is to really build the capacity of both the agency and their non-governmental partners to engage in collaboration. And one of the things that's very apparent in stewardship contracting is the importance of well-trained, well-qualified procurement people and staff.
Dr. Mosley, what are some of the challenges for why these strategies are not more widely used, either in other agencies or in other policy areas?
I think there's a lot of diverse reasons why collaboration is hard sometimes. Some of the factors I focus on in this report are really the conflicts between the old institutions that were for hierarchical and the newer desires to collaborate. I think that can be a real area of focus for senior executives. I think at the ground level, at the frontline level, you can both have community reluctance to collaborate sometimes, although I think that's becoming more and more rare, or you can have conflict that's so intense that every time people try to get a group together, it's sabotaged or something like that. You can also see in land management agency or in other many agencies, people didn't get into the business of being foresters or any number of other federal agencies because they wanted to work with people. They wanted to work with trees, and now they're being asked to work with people. I think, and I do think that the training component and helping the frontline staff understand how to collaborate and what collaboration is a key piece, but also I think there are these larger structural issues that can make it very difficult, whether it's political pressures or lack of authority or just, it's habit. And so habits are hard to break when they're in large bureaucracies.
Collaboration could have sort of a nebulous connotation or could take many forms. Given your research, what is collaboration, or could you provide us with the characteristics of good collaboration?
Sure. Well, collaboration, I think, is a nebulous concept, which means a lot of different things in a lot of different contexts, and that's actually a critical piece of it. But in the case of these forest collaboratives or public lands collaboratives, these are collaboratives happening at the ground level or at the community level, at the frontline management unit level. And they include groups of diverse stakeholders who are coming together in many cases after a long period of intense conflict. And so you have community folk, you have environmental interests, you have industry interests, you have the agency folks, and they're coming together to try to resolve conflict, address complex problems, discover common ground, and then through conversation, through going out into the field and looking at the woods, trying to find some agreement about how to move forward, and then taking action to actually move forward on the agreements that they build. So in some cases, there are multiple agencies at the table. Sometimes there's only one agency and a lot of different community people. But in any case, I think for the Forest Service and BLM, this has really been on the ground, muddy boots kind of collaboration. Let me suggest one that I think is particularly interesting, and although the report has several others. And where I come from, which is Western Oregon, we had a huge amount of conflict in the 1980s and 90s over management of national forests. The Northwest Forest Crisis or the Spotted Owl Crisis emerged, came to a head actually in the early 1990s. The old way of managing national forests was really no longer possible. But we had gotten to the point where people were screaming at each other, ugly signs and people's bumper stickers and bulletin boards and in storefronts. And it was a pretty rancorous and difficult time. And the agencies, the Forest Service, both the Forest Service and the BLM, it was a real low point, both in internal morale and in their ability to get their job done, because there's just so much conflict. And a national forest in Western Oregon called the Siuslaw National Forest, the supervisor then in the mid-1990s realized that that forest, which had been very focused on harvesting timber in a sort of industrial model, that was not going to be the way it was anymore. And he realized he needed to change how his forest was structured, what the goals of his forest were, and that rather than seeing the community as simply the recipients of timber that went down the road or logs that went down the road, that they were partners in managing the land. And that eventually led to something called the CIUSLA Stewardship Group when the stewardship contracts came about. And the CIUSLA National Forest went from a forest that was being sued and joined on timber sale after timber sale to one where there's broad agreement about how they can manage the land to restore endangered species, and they still send logs down the road. And so much of that was about restructuring the way that national forests worked internally and building partnerships with the local community residents and finding the common ground about where and how they should harvest timber and where and how they should restore it threatened and endangered salmon runs and spotted owls. I think what was interesting is that this was all well along the way when stewardship contracting came along, and they were able to take this collaboration and catapult it to a whole new level with this contracting authority that allowed them really to integrate the timber sale components and the restoration activities.
With all the research you performed and the interesting case studies you outline in your recent report for the IBM Center, are there any lessons that other federal agencies might learn from your efforts?
Well, I think that there are a number of lessons. In the report, I structure them essentially as, if you will, the lessons are, you know, the strategies and lessons are the flip side of each coin, of the same coin, if you will. But I think that for me, the lessons are about the importance of time and space, that collaboration on the one hand can be frustrating to people because it's nebulous and unclear. On the other hand, cookie cutter collaboration doesn't really work. And that's part of why collaboration is such an important tool, because collaboration is the ability to reflect the local community and context by being different and being adapted to the local social and ecological context. And so one of the key lessons is for senior executives to think through how do they support collaboration without killing it off. You can do too little and it never flourishes, and you can do too much and it becomes, you know, another form to fill out. And how do you strike a balance that really makes collaboration flourish, and while not leaving so much room for maneuver that people can just not bother? And I think a third lesson is that collaboration requires healthy partners as well as a healthy agency. And so figuring out how the agency gets its needs met, but also figure out how you have the partners be able to be real partners to the agency.
Dr. Mosley, what does the future hold?
Well, in some ways, it's very hopeful. Obviously, the federal government had for a long time some tough financial times, and particularly in land management. And certainly, we're headed for more tough financial times. But I think what's encouraging about collaboration and the new ways forward is that it does create a lot more trust and support in the federal government. It brings a lot more resources to the complex problems that these agencies are facing. And so I think that after 15 years of extremely difficult politics and change, the Forest Service and the BLM are really beginning to find a way that allows them to function on a day-to-day basis, allows them to achieve their goals, allows them to build the trust and the solutions that they really need with their partners. And so I guess the future for me, for these agencies, holds a lot of hope.
Dr. Mosley, thank you for joining us today. I really appreciate your perspective and your time.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate the opportunity.
That was Cassandra Mosley, author of Strategies for Supporting Frontline Collaboration, Lessons from Stewardship Contracting, a recent IBM Center for the Business of Government report. The research presented thus far in the special edition of the Business of Government Hour underscores that for collaborative approaches in government to work, it requires a major change in organizational culture. You can download a copy of this report and all of our Center reports at businessofgovernment.org. How can new approaches to public-private partnerships enhance food safety? We'll explore this and more with Professors Noel Grease and Monica Nogueira when the special edition of the Business of Government Hour, A Conversation with Authors, returns. Management of government projects, programs, and portfolios, and the related expenditures of public funds are major visible areas of interest and concern. Despite a growing stream of successful program and projects, failures continue at an alarming rate. Pick up the latest Center report, Project Management in Government, An Introduction to Earned Value Management, and find out how this powerful methodology can make your projects more successful. You can order or download a free copy of this and all of our Center reports at businessofgovernment.org. Whether it's the federal government's role in emergency management, its efforts in making operations more sustainable, responsible, and efficient, or the challenges being faced and innovations being forged by local governments during difficult economic times, The Spring 2010 edition of the Business of Government magazine offers timely, relevant, and thoughtful perspectives on all of these issues from leading practitioners and public managers. Hi, I'm Michael Keegan, managing editor of the Business of Government magazine, and we know it's all about making connections, introducing our readers and connecting them to the work of government executives who are leading agencies or initiatives that are focused on critical missions, missions important to them. In our latest edition of the Spring 2010 Business of Government magazine, we bring you conversations with FEMA Administrator Craig Fugate, who talks to us about the challenges facing his agency. Michelle Moore, Federal Environmental Executive, outlines sustainability efforts and greening federal operations. And Robert Doerr, Commissioner of the New York City Human Resources Administration, sheds light on how his agency is doing more with less. Our forum is dedicated to exploring ways government leaders and all leaders can make better decisions. All of this and so much more in the Spring 2010 edition of the Business of Government magazine. Order your free copy at businessofgovernment.org and find out how the business of government is not business as usual. Welcome back to the special edition of the Business of Government Hour, a conversation with authors exploring ideas to improving government effectiveness. I'd like to welcome our next guests, Noel Grease and Monica Nogueira, authors of the IBM Center report, Food Safety, Emerging Public-Private Approaches. Noel Grease, what prompted your research in this area of food safety?
Well, I guess in a word, it's China. I'm the co-director of a joint center with Tsinghua University in Beijing, the Center for Logistics and Enterprise Development. And I had been in China when the melamine scandal broke. I don't know if you recall, but back in 2008, there was a big contamination of melamine and milk products in China just prior to the Olympics. The melamine had been added to the milk supply to increase its protein content, or to make it appear that its protein content had been increased, and with pretty enormous consequences in terms of infants who suffered kidney disease and a number of deaths. We were in China working on developing cold chain capabilities. The cold chain is a supply chain that has temperature control capability so that you can keep food and other perishables at a constant temperature. And right after that, when I got back to the U.S., the PCA peanut contamination surfaced here in the U.S., and we became very interested in the comparative aspects of food safety regarding regulatory environments, different types of contamination, responses to it, and things like that.
Monica Nogueira, would you describe the current landscape of food safety?
It is difficult to estimate the true extent of food safety disease, but it can be safely be said that foodborne disease occurs more frequently than it is reported, and it incurs more costs than there are estimates for. In the last 10 years, we have had more than 20 major food contamination events that made thousands of people severely ill with very high health and economic costs. These events are distributed across many types of food products, but contaminations of meat, poultry, and fresh produce are the most prominent. We see that there are increasing opportunities for food contamination and that the cost for food contamination events are also increasing. And we think that one of the roots of this problem is the fragmentation of the U.S. food safety system, as well as the lack of authority of our regulatory agencies to mandate recalls, the inadequacy or inexistence of traceability systems and the food supply chain. In the last 20 months, we had 4 new food safety bills introduced into Congress to address this problem. So this is a problem that it really worries not only government but the public too. These 4 bills are the Food Safety Modernization Act, which was introduced in February 2009 and called for the creation of a new administrative agency within the U.S. Department of Health and Human Service. But this bill remains in committee. And then we had, in June 2009, the Food Safety Enhancement Act that was passed in the House of the Representatives by a vote of 283 against 142. And it has moved to the Senate, has been read twice, but has not been voted yet there. And this bill would increase the authority of the Health and Human Services, which houses the FDA, but will not create a new agency. And then we have two other bills that have been introduced into the Senate. And the first one is the FDA Food Safety Modernization Act, which is very similar to the Food Safety Enhancement Act, as well as the Safe Feast Act. And these are all similar to the Food Safety Enhancement Act.
No, Monica touched on a couple of reasons for why we are seeing an increase in food contamination. Perhaps you'd like to elaborate. Are there any other reasons besides fragmentation?
We really don't know the true extent of foodborne disease here in the U.S. People may have a mild gastrointestinal distress that's due to some kind of food contamination, and they don't go to the doctor, they don't report it. So we have no way of knowing. But we do believe it is quite extensive and really deserves and merits additional attention from the regulatory environment. Salmonella, for example, is probably a lot more frequently experienced than is reported. That said, we do believe that it's increasing, and for two reasons. First is the increasing complexity of the global supply chain, and also the increasing vulnerability of our population to these kinds of contaminations. From the supply chain side, we have more and more people who want fresh produce and foods that don't go through a heating or a pasteurization process. They're not canned or packaged. And this provides a lot more opportunity for contaminants to enter into the food system or into the product. And even more important probably is that many of our products are imported. They cross our borders, often from developing countries, and they often don't have very strong food safety controls like we do. And countries like China don't have cold chains either. So you have food products that are moving from the farm or the manufacturing site, the processing site, to the customer without any temperature control. In fact, in China, most meat is transported in an untemperature-controlled environment. So we have, you know, people buying more fresh produce. We have more products coming from overseas. These products are traveling farther, so they have more transport legs. And each time you transfer from one mode of transport to another, you have an opportunity for some kind of contamination. So, you know, the complexity of the supply chains really are contributing to the increasing food contamination. And another problem also, you know, with air transport and air cargo, contaminated food can travel across the world in a couple of hours, and it's very difficult to track and trace something.
That's a wonderful segue. One of the things I found most powerful with your report for the IBM Center for the Business of Government was the economic and health costs associated with food contamination. Perhaps you can give us a sense of that, and how much at the end of the day does all of this cost?
Well, we can look at both the economic and health costs. The available estimates from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention are already 10 years old, but they can provide an idea of the costs involved. And they say that 76 million people are affected by foodborne disease every year in the United States. From these, 325,000 are hospitalized, and we have 5,000 deaths. So from the human perspective, it's a huge cost right there. The USDA Economic Research Service tracks and estimates the cost of disease caused by specific pathogens, and they have created a cost calculator, a foodborne illness cost calculator they introduced in 2003 that is an interactive online cost estimator for five top pathogens. And when they computed the cases of salmonellosis, which is the illness caused by the Salmonella bacterium, in 2008, it came to approximately $2.6 billion. So we have a much more recent estimate done in March 2010 by Robert Scharf, a former FDA economist, and it puts the cost of foodborne disease in the U.S. to be as high as $152 billion. This amount does not only include medical costs, but it includes also the cost of premature death, lost productivity costs, and also public health costs related to the tasks of detecting, responding to an event. And many of these costs fall to local communities and to the states. On the economic side, we see that foodborne disease impacts companies, industry, and regional economies in a very substantial way, and the effects are very lasting. the calculus is very tricky, and we do not have a final tally yet. But if we take the Peanut Corporation of America contamination as an example in 2008, it has been estimated that this event alone cost nearly $1 billion. The Kellogg Company estimated that its loss would be around $75 million for that event.
But would you give us a high-level overview of how the food safety system currently operates?
So, in terms of the complicated structure, there are 15 different agencies and more than 30 different laws that govern food safety at the federal level. And right now, if you sort of try and look at the landscape of the regulatory bodies, the major tasks are divided between the FDA and the USDA. The FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, oversees about 80% of our food supply, including imported foods, foods that come into our country across borders. And the USDA, or really its FSIS, or Food Safety and Inspection Service, is responsible for the remaining 20%, and that includes meat, poultry, and processed egg products. There are a number of other agencies. The CDC, for example, I think Monica mentioned them earlier, has responsibility for surveillance and epidemiological activities to confirm and monitor and manage foodborne disease outbreaks. You know, the EPA, Department of Homeland Security, because remember, food safety also has a homeland security and terrorism aspect to it as well. They're also involved in food safety. So we have a very complicated structure at the federal level. But in all honesty, the bulk of the food safety work really happens at the local and the state levels. We have thousands of local health departments and various state departments of public health and agriculture all engaged in data gathering and analysis, inspections of various stakeholders and suppliers along the food supply chain.
Would you provide an overview of the collaborative framework you outline and recommend in your IBM Center report?
Monica and I are members of the Keenan Institute of Private Enterprise here at the University of North Carolina's Business School. And our mission here is to solve problems by engaging the private sector, the public sector, and the academy. And I think the public-private aspect of food safety is emerging. I think it's being recognized that we can't necessarily rely just on the public sector, on the FDA and the USDA, to help keep our food safe. We've been talking about a new stakeholder model that includes not just the public sector agencies, but also the private sector and also the consumer, who all have roles to play in keeping our food supply safe. Private sector on its own is also engaging in industry-wide efforts to alert suppliers and customers up and down the supply chain if problems are emerging. And it's in their interest that, you know, private sector companies want to maintain their brand. They want to maintain the safety of their products. So it's in their interest as well. These sort of collaborative approaches are really the way to go in the future, and the laws that are coming down also reflect this. One of the things that emerging out of the new legislation is this idea of risk-based approaches to managing food safety. This says that we'll put resources towards food safety where the risks are greatest. And for private sector companies, this means that if you do not have many violations and if you're not operating in a food industry that has a potential for a lot of contamination, then you probably do not have to be inspected as frequently, which is less of a burden to you. And together, there have been a number of meetings between government and private sector representatives to try and work out some of these risk-based approaches that make sense for both sides. And another area where the public and private sectors are coming together is in the area of track and trace. Track and trace, when we have a food contamination event, it's very important to be able to trace the supply chain back up to the source of the problem and also to track downwards to see where products may have gone that have been contaminated.
Monica, the consumer is where the buck stops, right? We are the ones who purchase the food. We are the ones who open the product and have a direct view of it. How key is consumer information to enhancing food safety in the United States?
many states, including especially North Carolina, maintain today consumer hotlines where consumers can call and report any problems they find in their food. We have information from the North Carolina Department of Agriculture. They issued an alert because a consumer has called and indicated they found metal in lollipop, and that triggered a major investigation with the proximity of Halloween season and the consequence that it can have since this product is going to go to children. So we see that consumer information is key, is a key aspect for the food safety system. We are working towards using this information, integrating this information with other types of information that comes from the private sector and from the monitoring agencies, and try to use that information in an intelligent way so we can detect as soon as possible that a problem may be appearing. Another aspect that the consumers contribute to is in social media today, because consumers are increasingly talking to each other directly and sharing almost everything about their personal lives on the internet. And using different platforms like Facebook and Twitter and other sites like YouTube to share what they live, where they have eaten, what they have eaten, and how they feel afterwards. And the sharing of information, which is mostly public, is a great source of data that we can collect and use for kind of a detection mechanism to see where problems may be occurring.
Noel and Monica, what does the future hold in the area of food safety?
I do see a more collaborative spirit between the public sector and private sector in terms of providing protective mechanisms for our food safety, our food supply chains. And I do see in the future a food safety bill being passed. I think another area where we're making a lot of progress is in new informatics tools to provide visibility into our food safety systems. This is an area that Monica mentioned earlier. And we're actively building many of these tools here in our laboratories at the business school. How can we gather information? What's the right information to gather? How can we fuse that information and use it to detect signals about potential contamination events and then respond to that event in a timely manner? One of the problems has been the extreme latency between the time of a contamination and the time that that last contaminated food product has been taken from the shelves of the grocery stores. And I think there are a number of new tools, information tools that are coming down the pike that will help us shorten that period.
I also would like to add that besides the information and the data collection, we will need new mechanisms, new devices to do this collection. There are some new devices that seem to promise to be able to smell your food for you and to tell you that it's getting spoiled. So I think that in this hardware area, there is also another possibility. It's still in very infancy, but I think we will see new things, new devices coming too.
That's a wonderful perspective, Noel and Monica, and I want to thank you for your time and more particularly for the great work you did for the IBM Center for the Business of Government.
It's been our pleasure. Thank you so much.
Partnerships between government regulators and industry evolved in the 1990s as a way of increasing compliance while reducing administrative burdens. Several recent high-profile cases have put into question the benefits of such partnerships. The three recent IBM Center reports profiled today offer a different perspective, showing the value of regulatory partnerships and collaboration between public and private sectors. I hope you've enjoyed this special edition of the Business of Government Hour, a conversation with authors exploring ideas to improving government effectiveness with Russ Mills, Dr. Cassandra Mosley, and Professors Noel Grease and Monica Nogueira. You may download a free copy of each report profiled on today's show, as well as all Center reports, at businessofgovernment.org. Be sure to join us next week for another informative, insightful, and in-depth conversation on improving government effectiveness. For the Business of Government Hour, I'm Michael Keegan, and thanks for joining us.
This has been the Business of Government Hour. Be sure to visit us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. There you can learn more about our programs and get a transcript of today's conversation. Until next week, it's businessofgovernment.org.
What are some of the critical transportation challenges facing the U.S.? How is the Research and Innovative Technology Administration, or RITA, advancing an intelligent transportation system? What is IntelliDrive, and what role does technology play in making our transportation system safe, secure, and efficient? Join host Michael Keegan next week for an encore presentation of the Business of Government Hour's conversation with Peter Apple, Administrator of the Research and Innovative Technology Administration within the U.S. Department of Transportation.